Bryant Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We built an important part of yesterday's show around this line from President Obama's Tucson speech.
Rather than pointing fingers or assigning blame, let's use this occasion to expand our moral imaginations, to listen to each other more carefully, to sharpen our instincts for empathy, and remind ourselves of all the ways that our hopes and dreams are bound together.
Now, after playing that excerpt yesterday, we took calls and online comments on what we have in common as Americans, regardless of our differences. Many of those things were very basic, which was a fine place to start, like from Kelly from Somerset, who called in.
We can all imagine losing a child and how horrible that would be, and we can all imagine our husbands dying in front of a bullet for us.
Now, on our discussion page for this on itsafreecountry.org, you listed other things that we have in common, as simple as the need to be loved is universal, wrote Sarah from Brooklyn. Both liberals and conservatives can agree that the average American ought to be able to finance their needs through fair compensation for honest work, wrote Jack from Central New Jersey. And waste, said Matt R. from Brooklyn. Everyone thinks the government should spend our money wisely and not on crap we don't need. Corruption is a unifying evil. So a few points of common ground to start out. And yet a good number of you on It's a Free Country were also skeptical or even cynical about the president and us focusing on this common goals theme. This came from left and right alike, but for opposite reasons. For example, Nelson wrote, "The problem with well-intended invitations like this, what do you think all Americans have in common, is that they are never extended by the right wing, the Republicans. It is always the left or the center, and I think these already know what we have in common." And on the other side, Jay wrote, "We should not let the acts of a crazy man that were not motivated by current discourse be transformed into an opportunity to squash this country's healthy discourse. Coming together in the name of our common goals and morality, inspiring and beautiful as it sounds, is simply the rhetoric of a liberal community organizer president using the current tragedy to try to ebb the current movement in the country towards self-reliance, autonomy, and austerity." So that's where we are going into today. And in the spirit of common ground and unpolarized thinking, I actually think there's some truth in both of those skeptic posts from left and right, just my personal opinion. But that shouldn't be the conversation ender, rather the conversation starter. We promised we'd follow up on the idea of common bonds today. So let's take the next step. And to take it, let's try this. I'm going to read something from Paul Krugman's New York Times column today. And we know he's on one side, but he responds here to the exact same lines in the Obama speech that our show did yesterday. So listen to his framing of morality and basic American values in the healthcare debate. And then I hope we can get some health reform liberals and health reform conservatives to call in. And I'll facilitate a short conversation about our commonalities and differences. The Krugman column is headlined "A Tale of Two Moralities." And part of it says, the great divide in our politics isn't really about pragmatic issues, about which policies work best. It's about differences in those very moral imaginations Mr. Obama urges us to expand, about divergent beliefs over what constitutes justice. Pretty basic. So, for example, he says, one side saw health reform with its subsidized extension of coverage to the uninsured as fulfilling a moral imperative. Wealthy nations, it believed, have an obligation to provide all their citizens with essential care. The other side saw the same reform as a moral outrage, an assault on the right of Americans to spend their money as they choose. So, listeners, I don't want to do a simple call-in on whether you agree with Krugman's framing. I'm asking for people who identify with either side of that to call in, and let's have a short discussion on the air. If you think universal health insurance, mandated or facilitated by the government, is a moral imperative in a wealthy nation, call in right now, And we also want to hear from you if you see Obamacare as a moral outrage, an assault on the right of Americans to spend their money as we choose. Can we get a couple of you who believe each of these things? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, if you're willing to participate. And instead of calling each other names like immoral, let's just compare those values, compare those first principles, compare our notions of freedom and morality and what we might even have in common if we drill another layer down. Will you do it? And don't be insulted if you call in and get bumped. We only have a few lines, and I want to make sure we get some people on each side. And this being New York, I'm sure we'll get many more calls immediately that say universal coverage is a moral imperative than say the opposite. But we want both sides, so we'll save some lines and call in right now if you identify with either side of that duality. If you think universal health insurance, mandated or facilitated by the government, is a moral imperative in a wealthy nation, and if you see Obamacare as a moral outrage, an assault on the right of Americans to spend their money as we choose. 212-433-9692. And while your calls are coming in, we will chat briefly with New York Magazine political correspondent Mark Heilman, co-author of the book Game Change about the Obama campaign. Hey, Mark, welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, I'm still John.
Oh, John Heilman. I'm confused. Of course, your co-author is Mark Halperin.
Correct.
And I conflated you into one person.
It's not a problem. Nice to be with you this morning.
It's another kind of common ground. You and Mark Halperin are now one human being. So your book was about the Obama campaign, and people are saying the Tucson speech was the closest thing to the sound and content of his campaign speeches since. Did you hear it that way?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, the president has, from the very beginning of his national political career, has hit on a lot of these themes. So this, I mean, in a thematic sense, this is very much in his wheelhouse, and I think you can draw a continuum, a straight line that goes from this speech all the way back to his 2004 convention speech in Boston, the one that put him on the map politically. I think there's the plea for civility, the plea for a more rational kind of conversation, and for a unifying unifying discourse, and also a way, as he says so often, a way of entertaining the possibility that we can in fact disagree without being disagreeable. That is a through line through Obama's rhetoric, and I think the other speech that this has a lot in common with, both in terms of its tone and its objective, and also in terms of the kind of the personal ownership that the president had over it. I'm in Washington right now and spent a lot of time at the White House over the course of this week. You know, President Obama was very invested in this speech, much more than most speeches. He wrote this speech himself to a large degree, mm-hmm. very similar in that respect to the race speech that he gave in Philadelphia in April of 2008, a speech that was very much from his heart and from his gut. There's a little great similarity there, and I think you saw that in the way that he tried to hit certain kinds of notes throughout it.
So give me some pure political analysis of what you think the president was up to in that speech, besides the part that was from the heart and from the gut, which is undeniable. But if we accept the notion that Jared Loughner was not responding to Tea Party rhetoric, and the jury's still out on that, but we certainly don't have evidence that he was. If you accept that notion, was the president's civility framing less about the causes of the shooting than what came after?
Yes. I think very much so, and I think that the White House and the president personally looked at what happened after the shooting, that you know that there were a lot of people who thought that the shooting would happen and that there would be a pause. That would be a natural pause in the shouting and the screaming on both sides that characterized so much of our political dialogue today. And instead, the screaming and the shouting only escalated. And in the 4 days after the shooting, things got worse. And it was like almost an object lesson in incivility rather than civility. And I think the president and a lot of people around him were sort of dismayed by that, but also saw that as an opportunity for them. Because if he had spoken about the past, if he talked about the extreme rhetoric of the past 2 years of his administration, that would have been seen by some people as implying that somehow the past 2 years was the cause of what happened in Tucson. I don't think the president believes that, for one thing, but also it would have actually just worsened the situation if he had implied that. But by talking primarily about the reaction to the shootings and then framing the speech in terms of the present and the future, he was able to talk about it in a way that both the left and the right could hear as a coded admonition of the other side. You could hear President Obama's speech as being kind of warning people on the left who were blaming Sarah Palin for what happened in Tucson. You could also see it as warning people on the right. And I think since both sides could hear that as being directed at the other side, they were more open to listening to the message. And I think that's part of why both the right and left have responded really positively and favorably toward the speech.
So you think it worked in terms of Obama. What about on the larger question of the climate and even political advantage, to get that directly, you know, political about it? Have you seen any polling? Has this whole intense week of talking about crosshair maps and blood libel and shared hopes and dreams and Gabrielle Gifford's remarkable recovery so far and a murdered 9-year-old's expectations of her government and all of that, has it careened to the benefit of one party or another, or Palin or Obama?
Well, I haven't seen any polling on this, Brian, and I'm not sure I would trust a lot of polling in this close to the event to really tell us very much. But I will say that I think from the White House's point of view, they realized gradually, it dawned on them since the midterm elections, that the president needs to get up into a more elevated place. But one of their problems in the last 2 years was being seen too much and acting too much as a legislative leader, almost a prime minister. And they have sought in various ways to put him back on the presidential plane. You saw that during their lame duck session where he adopted a posture of, you know, I'm going to be the adult here, the kind of presiding over petulant children in both parties. And you saw that in December. I think they would never have wanted this to happen, obviously. But this did create another opportunity for the president to get back up in that high presidential place. And in much the same way as, you know, Bill Clinton did with Oklahoma City, there are a lot of things that are not similar between Tucson and Oklahoma City. But, you know, Bob Shrum, the Democratic speechwriter and consultant, said to me the other day, you know, the main thing that was true about Oklahoma City was that the president went to Oklahoma City. He looked, before that, he had been reduced to the leader of a faction, and he came back from Oklahoma City as a president again. And I think President Obama, something similar is true of him in this case, that this puts him in an elevated place that is good for him politically going forward in a totally abstract sense, not in some narrow tactical sense, but in a grand sense. It puts him where he wants to be going forward over the next 2 years.
John Heilman, New York Magazine, political columnist. For a few minutes, as your calls are coming in, if you think health care is a moral imperative in this country or if Obamacare is a moral outrage, to have a different kind of conversation, putting some of you on the air at the same time. John, in our unscientific poll on itsafreecountry.org yesterday, we asked, how much do you think the tragedy in Tucson and President Obama's speech will improve the tone of politics in America? A lot, a moderate amount, or very little? And 118 people, or two-thirds, said things will change very little. Only 6% predicted they will change a lot. As a professional political analyst, what do you think?
Well, if I first want to say that if you had asked me what I thought your poll would say, given and I love New York, as you know, but we are a cynical group of people, and I'm not surprised that they had that view. And frankly, I'm a cynical person also to some extent, and I sort of share that view. I don't know. I hope that I'm wrong, because I actually think this is a really important issue in American life. But I do think that there's a pretty good chance that a few weeks from now, a few months from now, that the rhetoric will be very much the same as it's been over the course of the last 2 years. This is not something that has started 6 months ago or even 2 years ago with President Obama's election. You know, we've had a coarsening and a polarization of our political rhetoric that goes back now, really starting with Bill Clinton. It's been 20 solid years. I don't think that any one incident or any one speech is going to change that easily or soon.
Well, never mind 6 months from now. What about next week when Congress goes back to the health reform repeal debate? Does the content of it change? Does the tone of it change? Do they say tyranny a few less times? Do they look for compromise proposals to replace parts of it with? Anything at all?
Well, I think, look, I actually think that as of right now, at least, that Speaker Boehner conducted himself really well over the course of the last week, and Republicans have by and large really, you know, reacted with dignity, and they did all the right things this the course of the last week. I think there's a chance that the tone of that debate will be milder. I don't think that the key thing here, and Brian, you said the right thing here when you talked about tyranny and so on. You know, I don't think that the president or anybody else thinks that we shouldn't have thorough, vigorous, disagreement about what we ideological disagreement about the things that about issues of principle and issues of substance. I just think that the question of do we need to have some of this of this violent rhetoric and some of the more extreme rhetoric is what's on the table here. And I think there's a chance that, I mean, in purely political terms, I think Speaker Boehner knows that he has got to manage some of the elements of his new caucus that are most prone to that kind of language, and it will be very interesting to watch, because I think he would prefer to have a debate that was, again, thorough and vigorous and doing what the Republicans believe on health care, mm-hmm. but not have it infected with that kind of rhetoric. And I don't know how well he'll be able to do that. This is a wild card situation. You've got a lot of these freshman Tea Party Republicans. We have no idea how they're going to react, but it's going to be, I think, in a way, it's going to be a real telling sign, at least in terms of what the tone's going to be like going forward, how that plays out, and whether Speaker Boehner is going to be able to kind of keep some of that tamped down.
So before we get to our call-in and pairs of callers on morality and health care and common ground and the tone of the discussion, Senator Tom Udall, Democrat from Colorado, is proposing that at the State of the Union address, senators and congresspeople sit differently from usual. Rather than Democrats on one side of the aisle, Republicans on the other, they actually mingle and sit together to show this post-Arizona unity. How's that going down with Republicans?
I don't think a lot. First of all, I think it's a great idea, and it would be it would change the whole nature of the State of the Union in a way, because right now it's kind of like a football game, right, where one side applauds, one side cheers on certain moments, and the other side stands up and cheers at other moments, and one side, they don't boo exactly, but they sit on their hands. If you had everybody interspersed among one another, it would be a very different kind of tenor. It would be a lot harder to have that kind of audience reaction to what the president says, and that would change the whole mood of the State of the Union. I don't think it will happen because not just I think because Republicans don't want it to happen, but I'm not sure that there's a wide sense among Democrats that, mm-hmm. that people want that to happen either. I think that the parties do see themselves as teams and they like to sit together rather than sit with the people on the other side.
All right, so listeners, that's the topic of our free country, thoroughly unscientific poll question today. Senator Tom Udall, Democrat from Colorado, proposes that Democratic and Republican members of Congress sit among each other at the State of the Union address rather than in partisan blocks. Do you like this idea a lot? Like it, but it doesn't mean much? Or oppose this idea because it sends the wrong message? Register your answer at our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. Let's see how you cynics respond to this. And we thank John Heilman, political correspondent for New York Magazine, co-author of Game Change, the book about the Obama campaign. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
And coming up in just a minute, we'll get to that dialogue among some of you who think universal health care is a moral imperative or a moral outrage. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now to your calls for a dialogue among some of you who think universal health care is a moral imperative or a moral outrage. We're going to put two callers on together, Alex in Mamaroneck and Colin in Carroll Gardens. Alex in Mamaroneck, are you there?
I am.
Thanks so much for joining this conversation. And Colin in Carroll Gardens, how about you?
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
Good. Colin, Alex. Alex, Colin.
Hi, Colin.
Hey, Alex.
Let's get to know each other a little bit. Colin, where'd you grow up, and what formed your politics?
Well, it's funny. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and my dad was literally a Reagan Republican. But as I grew up, I actually found my own politics becoming more libertarian, basically.
And Alex and Mamaroneck, how about you? Where'd you grow up, and where'd your politics come from?
I grew up in Mamaroneck in Westchester, and influenced mostly by this area in New York City. I've always been, from a Democratic perspective.
Were there any formative moments in either of your lives? Like, Colin, if your parents were Reagan Republicans, which a lot of our listeners might think is pretty libertarian, but you say you migrated from that to more libertarian, Was there an issue along the way or an event or some kind of gradual evolution? Can you put your finger on something?
Well, for me, you know, I always describe myself as sort of a Giuliani Republican until, you know, Giuliani got to towards the end of his term, in which case, you know, it was the social issues that ostracized me from the Republican Party. Like, you know, I always viewed myself as very accepting of, you know, all sorts of social issues that the Republican Party doesn't, like on abortion, on, you know, just anything that takes place in the home or bedroom.
Right.
You know?
Right. So along the Liberty
Party doesn't address that.
So government off our backs, both in our personal lives and our economic lives.
Absolutely.
The pure libertarian position. And Alex, how about you? Did you just kind of grow up in this liberal New York milieu and there you always were, or were there some galvanizing events along the way in your life?
I think that I think it's a little bit of both. I can't put my finger on a specific galvanizing event, but I've always felt that I've always been sensitive to social issues. I think that it has an impact on society as a whole and that government plays a role in it because it's necessary from a perspective of a large organization of people that you have to have some sort of an organization. I have a great deal of respect for the libertarian point of view. However, as society gets larger and more complex, just the nature of the actions of people requires some sort of organization, and that basically leads towards a form of government in one way or another.
How do either of you think that your political philosophies touch your own lives? In other words, outside of the realm of what you abstractly think is right or wrong, Colin, as a libertarian, do you feel the strong thumb of government on your life in some way that, you know, personally affects you or anything like that?
Well, I mean, you know, I think a lot of people think that libertarians are paranoid people, and I'm definitely not. I mean, I don't feel like the government on my back every day. But, I mean, for instance, I have gay family members, and, you know, it's through the power of government I've seen, you know, gay marriage banned across the country. So, you know, it's like stuff like that affects me and my family. I mean, I'm not gay personally, but I mean, why should my family members not be able to have the same kind of relationships that I do?
And for you, there's a connection between the government not prohibiting that and the government not telling you to spend money on a health insurance policy?
Well, what bothers me about government telling me to spend money on a health insurance policy is that if they can tell me to spend money on a health insurance policy, where can they tell me to spend money next? I mean, like, you know, it to me, I view that as a gross breach of their powers of interstate commerce. Like, you know, if they wanted true interstate commerce, they should allow me to buy and carry health insurance plans across state lines. But instead, they're telling me I need to buy a health insurance policy, and I have to do that, otherwise I incur a tax penalty. You know, what happens next year? I mean, you know, will they say, well, you know, Chevy's in trouble, so every American needs to buy a Chevy or incur a tax penalty, you know, because interstate policy or interstate commerce, you know, gives them the power to do so.
And, Alex, I don't want to engage on that point right now. I hear you taking a breath, ready to do that. But
yeah.
How about for you, coming from your more liberal politics and personal interest? Do you see, you know, a threat to your future or your children's future? I don't know if you have kids or whatever, from the current Republican or conservative or Tea Party movement that you feel personally?
Okay. Well, with respect to the healthcare discussion, I find that it is it's a moral imperative to have healthcare for a nation as a society, because it is part of the productivity of the nation. It's part of the growth. If you allow poverty, or you allow sickness to develop and to carry on unchecked, you basically create a situation where those who are not sick, who are not in threat of health problems, to be at risk by the people who are. If you create a situation where you have growing numbers of people who don't have health care, don't have access to health care, eventually they will cross your path. There will be people who are providing goods and services. There will be people who are working in your workplace. There will be people that you will be crossing every day. That type of thing will, A, erode the productivity of the people you're working with, and B, put you and your family, your children at school, and and anybody else at risk for health issues. That's why it's important as the society grows in number, when it gets larger and larger, that you have to make sure that the health of the society is being taken care of. It's somewhat draconian for a government to have to enforce something like that, but if you don't have the government involved in that, then you run the risk of the sickness growing to a point where it threatens those who are not.
Alex,
and that's why it's in our own self-interest to have that done.
Alex, were you able to hear Colin's argument about why he feels it's a moral outrage for government to require? Can you articulate it? Articulate it as if you were him.
I don't think it's a moral outrage. I think it's a gross misuse of government power.
Okay.
Colin's point of view, where it's a slippery slope. Once you allow government to start making decisions for you, where will they stop? And you know what? There is no question on the line. The government does make decisions that are not always in our best interest, even though they claim that they are. My concern should be the concern of many, that government is unduly influenced by business rather than government influencing business. We have more businesses actually influencing the direction of government than the government influencing the direction of businesses.
I absolutely agree.
And I think that's a concern. You know, when the government starts making policy in the interest of developing business, that's fine. But when business starts making decisions on how government's going to run things, where the healthcare industry is influencing the policy of mm-hmm. healthcare being provided, that is an absolute concern. And I do agree with you on that, Colin. But it doesn't mean that we can't move forward, and it doesn't mean that providing health care, you know, or ensuring that the health of a society is not being taken care of, that has to be addressed, because that is as great a threat to the productivity and the growth of a society as not doing it at all.
And, Colin, can you speak back Alex's main argument? Can you just say it to know that you heard it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I absolutely agree that we need to take care of the less fortunate and do that in some way. I think that, you know, the solution that Obama and the previous Congress chose to adopt is wrong. But I absolutely agree that it's important to take care of the less fortunate. I mean, you know, To me, what I see when I see this healthcare bill is I see crony capitalism, where the health insurance, you know, the big health insurance lobby and the hospital industry and the doctors lobby has gotten in bed with government to mandate what's best for them as opposed to what's best for us. You know,
I
don't necessarily
that.
See a mandate as being necessary for us to take care of the less fortunate.
I agree that it's absolutely, you know, a concern that the healthcare has way too much. Well, healthcare industry had way too much influence on the creation of this policy. But I also believe that something had to be done. I consider it an open door or a way to move towards creating a better healthcare program rather than doing nothing at all or continuing on the path where we are, where the healthcare industry was running amok anyway.
But we're talking about billions of dollars. Like, you know,
I mean,
to do something, we're talking about the government literally spending billions of dollars where they haven't before. You know,
argument to be looked at both ways because you know, there are, you know, the current proposal says, you know, the claims about the current proposal is that it's actually saving a great deal of money, saving billions of dollars. The government is spending less money in managing these proposals than that they are by letting things go in the current path that it had been before the healthcare.
That money was like the healthcare bill was supposed to save money if they didn't pass the Medicare doctor's fix, which they did then pass. So now immediately it's now running, it's now adding to the deficit as opposed to saving from the deficit, which is what the CBO originally projected. Mm.
So let me stop you guys for just a second. It's a great conversation, and you had some points of common ground in there, and you were certainly able to hear each other and reflect back each other's primary thoughts. Is there anything that either of you can think of that would kind of respect the other's concerns and still move this thing forward, you know, off the polarized kind of all or nothing that they are stuck in Congress right now? That's hard.
That's really
that
hard. Getting off a polarized all or nothing, it would require a complete paradigm shift in the nature of our politics right now. And right now, our politics is all or nothing on anything. I don't really see we're getting away from an all or nothing approach on anything in the near future. You had mentioned earlier that it took 20 years or 30 years to get between when Bill Clinton first got in office and, you know, where we are now, where things have been steadily becoming more and more polarized. That's not going to change in any near future. And right now, our government is very, very much split. And it's not just the government, but it's also our society. Folks really believe that it's us or them, and that does have to change before our government can change. Otherwise, you're going to have the difference between people claiming their decisions are leadership versus other people claiming it's tyranny.
Colin, how about you?
Well, I basically think that you know, like, our legislatures need to start listening to the voters as opposed to the lobbyists. You know, and I'm not you know, recommending any sort of legislation to limit, you know, businesses' voice, but I'm saying that, you know, at the end of the day, we are the voters, so they should be listening to what the public opinion is, and you know, try and come up with a moderate opinion based upon that.
I think that would be really difficult to do at this point going forward because of, first of all, the Citizens United ruling that allows businesses and individuals and lobbyists to pump as much money as they want to into individual campaigns or directly to politicians. And as a representative government, it's very difficult to listen to your constituents on every point. In other words, we elect representatives to go forward as leaders. I don't think that there's an opportunity for them to go back to the people for every initiative. It's just,
well,
you know,
I'm not saying that they should come back to us, Alex. Like, I'm thinking, you know, like, but at the same time, I disagree with the point that we're electing leaders. I mean, we live in a republic, so we've elected a democracy, not a representative democracy. So they
that's what I mean.
Of those people that live within their district. And
it is,
I mean,
you look at
the healthcare law, and it's universally unpopular across most districts, and yet they went ahead and did it anyway.
I would disagree with that about being universally unpopular. If you ask people about specific elements of the healthcare law, you will find a lot of people will say, I like this, and I like the fact that I'm going to the parents can look after their kids or have their children on their health care till the 26. If you ask folks about you know, certain elements of it, they'll say I'm all for it. If you ask folks about how do you feel about Obamacare, universally everybody says no, because basically that's the dialogue. Mm-hmm. That Obamacare or, you know, this health care for the federal health care program is a terrible idea.
So,
but the number one most unpopular thing is the mandate.
So,
I mean, you have to admit that. Like, people do not like the mandate. They don't like government telling us where we have to spend our money.
Yeah, but we have mandates on insurance, you know, for auto insurance, even though it's not the federal government that's mandating.
Actually,
it's certainly the local government.
Sorry, Brian, if I can just talk about the mandate. That's a great point. Like, we have, you know, the courts have ruled that driving is a privilege, and we can opt out of getting health, we can opt out of getting driving, you know, like collision insurance,
right,
and all the rest, by not driving.
I'm going to jump in, just because I don't want to go down this same rabbit hole that we've been down.
The mandate for health insurance is a mandate, but, you know, we have to buy it for the simple fact of being alive. There is
opt-out.
It's not the same as the driving mandate, because the driving mandate, we can actually opt out by not driving.
So to finish this up, because now we're running out of time, and again, this has been great, and I thank you both very much for engaging as regular citizens and, you know, not professional politicians or interest group members. Is there a point of common ground that we could leave on, shared values as to what we want for America with respect to health care, with respect to health insurance? Are you both driving toward the same thing, but in very different ways, or not even?
I'm not seeing us going to this driving towards the same thing, for the simple point of the opt-out portion. The reason why I'm saying this is because if you opt out, let's say something like a health care perspective, then you are putting a burden on the rest of society to cover you when you require health, when you're going to require health care to cover you if you can't cover it yourself, or that if you're going to get sick because you're not taking care of yourself, you're also putting other people at risk.
But where do you want to be, Alex? 30 seconds. Where do you want to be at the end of the day in terms of people having coverage? What's the what's the sort of bottom line goal or value?
I think we need, it would be, personally, I would prefer to see some sort of a universal coverage for everyone, like a Medicare for everyone. But that seems like something we'll never be able to get to or fund. Mm-hmm. I think we should be able to have a large program where it's available for everyone to get mm-hmm. into, but not mandated.
And Colin, where do you want to get to?
I'd like to see the less fortunate in society be taken care of. I mean, I think that is a burden that, as a society, we should bear, absolutely. I would just also like to, see a real market emerge as far as healthcare for those of us who could participate in it. And that's basically it.
Listen, I thank you guys. This was a great conversation. And I don't know, in the spirit of shared values, you think we should have more conversations like this?
I love it, Brian. And by the way, can I say, I think you should post your theme song as a ringtone on the website.
Yeah, it's pretty good, people.
I have to see if we have the rights. Alex, what?
I was going to say, yeah, that is a good theme song. And yeah, I do think we should carry on the conversation. It's a good thing that the conversation goes on. I think it would be great if it goes on without the rhetoric and goes on without all the heated debates.
Absolutely, Alex. Thank you. I appreciate it.
So let's end it right there. Alex and Mamarinik, Colin and Carol Gardens, great job. And listeners, you can engage like this yourself at any time today on our politics website. We've got a structure up so that you can keep doing this kind of thing on a comments page with each other, and hopefully people who think that the president's health reform is a moral imperative or a moral outrage or places in between will go and discuss at itsafreecountry.org. And don't forget, we do have that poll question up there about Senator Udall. I think I may have misspoke before and said he's from Colorado. I guess Senator Udall is from New Mexico. That Senator Udall proposing that Republicans and Democrats mingle rather than sit on opposite sides of the aisle during the State of the Union address later this month. You like that idea? Go and register your opinion at itsafreecountry.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.